It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
This week's Democratic National Convention was like no other. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Gone were the large crowds that filled the hall with the hats and campaign buttons. The roll call for the presidential nomination saw representatives located in their states casting ballots to put former Vice President Joe Biden over the top to become the presidential nominee. Convention wrapped up with Biden making his acceptance speech, and there were 18 politicians like the Clintons, disaffected Republicans, as well as a new generation such as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. To assess the convention, we have two Salisbury University political science professors. Online with us is Adam Hoffman, and in the studio, Michael Laughlin. Well, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Don.
Good morning.
So, Adam, I'm going to turn to you and ask you, what was your overall sense about how this convention went?
I thought it went pretty well. I mean, everyone was surprised, as you said. There's, you know, never been a televised, political convention like this without the crowds, without the balloons, without the sort of raucous cheering. I mean, in past conventions, the role of the convention is to do just that, have that party to really amplify the message of the base. But I think they pulled it off, and maybe that has something to do with the fact that, we were just talking offline about how popular Zoom has become. People are kind of used to this medium. It allowed the politicians and the speakers to have a sort of, I think, more intimate connection with the audience to communicate their message. It wasn't overly produced, so it wasn't, a slick presentation, which some people were sort of afraid of. But I think they hit a lot of important points that they wanted to with this entirely new way of doing conventions.
Michael, it does seem as if, absent the crowds, the messages became much clearer. There wasn't the distraction of all the hoopla. And perhaps that this was the right form at the right time, given what we're experiencing.
Well, the one goal, a critical goal of any convention, party convention, is to unify behind the presidential nominee. And I think that the Democrats successfully did that. They achieved that goal. It was clear. I mean, with Senator Warren and Senator Sanders were speaking up for Biden, and so that the warring parties within the divisions that are there within the Democratic Party were at least covered over and unified in the presentation of the convention. It remains to be seen, of course, is whether or not the convention will have get a bump in the polls, because that's another kind of goal that you want to see, that you will have motivated voters, both the Democrats and certainly independents, and additionally inspiring the coalition activists. I mean, that remains to be seen as well, but I think it's promising. I mean, I think that Biden gave a very strong speech at the end. And there are going to be plenty of clips from that I think can be quite useful.
Alan, turning to Biden's address, one of the observations actually made by Chris Wallace over at Fox was that essentially Biden had blown a hole, as it were, in this claim by Trump that he's this doddering old man, that he hasn't really got it together, that he stumbles around. It seems as if he really kind of dispelled that.
Yeah, I mean, again, to without an audience, I think if an audience was there, he would have blown them away. I mean, it was a pretty energetic speech. He made as did the whole convention, but certainly in the culmination of Biden's speech, making the contrast between the president and him, casting it in terms of lightness and darkness, and I think that was a pretty powerful argument by Biden. I just want to pick up also one thing that Mike was saying about the activist base. I mean, I think if I were to criticize the convention. I mean, I think that was the one thing that they didn't do enough. I don't think they had enough of the really sort of progressive wing of the Democratic Party. I don't think they gave them nearly enough airtime. On the other hand, as Mike also said, I mean, I think you had Sanders really gave a quote of full-throated endorsement and, you know, made the case that his supporters this time around should not stay home, right? But, you know, we'll see, as I said, if that's going to be enough.
Yeah, if I may just double down on part of that. One sense, the digital format, this virtual format, is the campaign manager's dream, because it does give the campaign much more control over how things are going to unfold during the convention, whereas the real-life convention, I mean, these days, they're more controlled than I think certainly in past decades. But nonetheless, you know, the 2016 Democratic Convention was raucous because there was disagreement and the divisions were exhibited on the convention floor and the speeches and the like. And while the downside is you don't get the kind of unified message, the upside is that's really Democratic politics with a small d. That is that you really do get a sense how we see these different points of view and the base for those views. And I think Adam's absolutely right that there was really insufficient voice here from the Warren camp and from the Sanders camp, that we didn't see enough of that, and I think. And so it was perhaps in that respect it went over the edge a little bit in terms of too much of a managed presentation.
Well, one of the things that struck me, and over a number of different speakers, including Biden, but as well as former President Obama, and even the historian John Meacham, was this idea that this was greater than just simply the politics of the moment or even a particular platform, that this was, to use their words, obviously, you fight for the soul of America, that there was something that beyond simply party politics. Obviously, they brought in some Republicans, not the A-list, but they were there nonetheless, endorsing Biden. But it does seem as if, Alan, as if they tried to raise this above just simply the normal election give and take.
Yeah. I mean, this was definitely, this was the first convention or modern convention where you saw this presentation of this, the greatest threat to America, to lives, to freedoms. It wasn't a foreign nation, terrorism, Wall Street. It was the person in the Oval Office currently, the incumbent president. And, you know, you've never seen a theme that take place at a political convention. So, yeah, I mean, sort of this larger-than-life issues, again, presenting this contrast between, you know, the light of Biden and the decency and calmness that he can offer, and the chaos and darkness of Trump and then the president administration. That was the theme that was woven throughout all the nights. I thought it was really, interesting and I guess predictable that, again, sort of the main theme that came up, of course, was the pandemic, right? And just presenting the pandemic and the results of it as this crisis of leadership. I mean, just about every speaker, you know, hit home on that point. So that was definitely a unifying theme throughout.
As a matter of fact, I mean, former President Obama certainly struck that, essentially saying that he hasn't grown into the job. And it seems as if it and certainly got a response, certainly from the president. I mean, he tweeted a number of times. He said, quote, he being Obama, spied on my campaign, got caught, made some reference to not endorsing Biden right away, I guess, during the campaign. So it does seem to me, Michael, that that he did hit a chord there with the president.
For sure. I mean, I think that Barack Obama's speech was one of the most important speeches of the convention, and clearly went after the basic character of Trump. I'd add an additional piece to that, one phrase within the speech, of course, was Trump and his enablers. And that wasn't a particularly disguised critique of other Republican officials within the Republican Party. So that he was taking aim at the down ballots as well, I think. That was an important piece. Vocalized more loudly during the convention that this is the problem that we face is not simply this particular president, but a party, the Republican Party, that has become corrupted and is enabling the undermining of basic democratic principles. So the problem is perhaps more severe than the simple president.
Alan, do you think it went that far? I mean, I know that that the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi linked Trump to McConnell in her criticism of the president, but that seemed to me about as far as it went in terms of attacking the party per se. That it was really focused on Trump, and obviously the Republicans who spoke feel that maybe if this is over, that they can rejoin their party. Do you think there was enough emphasis on that? How do you see that playing out?
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with Mike. I mean, there wasn't, but you know, I'm not sure if there necessarily had to be. Again, you know, the convention, you know, it was focused on one person, really. It was focused on Donald Trump, and you know, as much as Obama sort of weaved in the Constitution, and I think that was a powerful argument, he really did not hold back on Trump, right? Making this powerful argument that Trump is either lazy or intellectually overwhelmed, or maybe both. I mean, it was scorching criticism on Obama's part. One quote Obama said in the speech: "The circus of it all, the beanness, the lies, the conspiracy theories." Really, Obama's sort of typical pedantic tone of parental tone of disbelief and anguish that I tapped into what a lot of people feel about the Trump administration. So, you know, I even though there were a few nights, as I said, the focus really was on one man, not necessarily the party that he represents right now.
Michael, the other thing I noticed was that women played a large role in this, not only as the hosts, as it were, for each night, but there was a great deal of emphasis on that. I'm assuming, in part, from a tactical point of view, obviously, they want women to turn out for Biden. But are they trying to say more than that, do you think, than just simply a political tactic?
I think it perhaps is reflective of the growing gender gap between the two parties. I think I just saw a recent poll that was incredible in terms of the double-digit lead presently that Biden has with regard to women. I think that is reflective, but I think just many more women now within the Democratic Party than in the Republican Party. And again, I think in terms of the House of Representatives, the number of women are extraordinary versus very few, actually, Republican women there. So I think it's reflective of that, of the power of women now within the Democratic Party. But I would think as well that it is tactical as well, because a key voting constituency now that's being targeted, of course, is suburban women. Trump wants to classify those folks as 1950s housewives, but that's incorrect. And I think that the Democrats wisely were targeting that particular constituency during the convention.
Alan, what do you think?
Adam, I think you're calling me Alan.
Oh, I'm sorry, Adam. Go ahead.
I mean, it was really, they took advantage of showcasing the, you know, incredibly important role that was now. Every couple of years, like, okay, this is it. You know, this is a decent amount of women got elected. But, I mean, this is... there's no going back right now as far as the dominant role that women are going to begin to play in the Democratic Party, both in the elected officials, when you had the New Mexico governor, Pelosi, Gabrielle Giffords, you know, a heartfelt speech, you know, and Harris and Clinton, and so, and of course, and as Mike said, yeah, I mean, they're such an important dominant role, both as elected officials and in the electorate. And, you know, that was, of course, illustrated by Biden's early promise that his VP pick would be a woman, and that's exactly what he did. So, yeah, I mean, that was a very important message for the Democratic Party to get across during this convention.
I want to turn it to Kamala Harris. She made her debut, as it were, I guess. Michael, first of all, what did you make of the address, and how effective do you think it was?
Of all the speeches, I thought that her speech, unfortunately, was the weak one of the weaker speeches. Frankly, now to be sure, VP candidates have to have a more subdued presentation to the, because they can't upstage the nominee, the presidential nominee. But I thought in terms just of her style, I didn't find it as exciting. Having said that, however, I think that the substance of her speech, clearly she was clearly going after the African-American community to mobilize that constituency, because that has powered Biden to the nomination, and it will be the power that will bring about his presidency, if that turns out to be the case. So I think that, it was effective in that case.
Adam, what do you think? I mean, because at one point I noticed she said, talking about how she had been a prosecutor, and there's that line, which I missed initially, which was, quote, "I know a predator when I see one," and then she paused. What do you make of that?
She didn't pull any punches when it came to calling out Trump, you know, with regard to that. I mean, I also agree with Mike, you know, I mean, I could clearly... If you were a fly in the wall of the people who were directing her, they told her, you know, you better tone it down, because, of course, we've seen her, you know, much more enthusiastic, over-the-top speeches when she was on the campaign trail. But, you know, as Mike said, they clearly told her to tone it down. But even with that, Don, no, you're right. I mean, you know, when she really called out Trump, talk about his callousness and incompetence and cynicism, right? She said, right now we have a president who turns our tragedies into political weapons. You know, even though she definitely called out Trump and, you know, didn't pull any punches, I think most of her speech was sort of an optimistic, more of this affirmation that we're not necessarily trapped in this Trump era, that there's a way to get out of it. By coming out to vote for Joe.
One of the other things that struck me is that when I was watching some of the speakers, Clinton and obviously Biden, but others, that a lot of them seem to be old. I mean, they got old somehow, and it stood in contrast. And obviously, as a matter of fact, they dominated, it seemed to me. Sort of the major features, as it were, as opposed to the younger generation, which we saw, you know, in the little cameos and lots of little clips and so on. But the heavy hitters, Michael, still seem to be that older generation. And do you think, in some ways, and I was beginning to wonder whether or not this was going to be the last time we see these people, or most of them? What do you think, Mike?
That assumes that we're still around for as well. So right. Maybe we're not going to see anything. But I think that's true. And I think it was, I mean, again, I have to, again, I wasn't in the back rooms where they were planning this thing, but they have to have been strategic about this. So I think part of it is that the aim is to eat away. I mean, Biden certainly wants to eat away at any kind of Trump advantage with regard to the older citizen. And again, as we were talking about before the show, the Biden is not even a baby boomer. He's a wartime.
Right.
So he's really a throwback in this respect. But he has the ability really to appeal to the older voter. And I think that part of the lineup here of all these older speakers, it, you know, again, it's reflective. I mean, Sanders was important, prominent, right? Clearly competitive. So I think that, but I think that the choice then was made. And perhaps there was some error as well, because I think Ocasio-Cortez, for example, perhaps could have been given a larger time frame as well. So, but they chose to go older rather than younger, and it has to be for a strategic reason. I mean, older voters are more reliable voters, okay? Perhaps that was the choice.
Adam, do you think in some ways this convention will see as maybe a transition convention when it comes to the older generation as opposed to the newer people coming up?
Yeah, I mean, you could really look at it as sort of like a handoff to the younger generation. And you could even say that. I think a lot of people did talk, and, you know, people sort of suspect that you know, Biden, whether or not he's going to serve out his term, serve two terms, that this is, as you said, a sort of a transition, passing the torch from these older generations of Democrats, your Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leadership in Congress, and the Democratic nominee. I agree with what you guys were saying about, I mean, at least the first part of the convention, the first couple of nights, it didn't really offer much to younger voters. You had Colin Powell, Kerry, Kasich. I mean, these people do not have a lot of millennial or Gen Z fans. I mean, I think a lot of progressives were kind of worried about the older, the tone catering to older folks in the first couple of days of the convention. This generation gap is really, I mean, this is a very important sort of cleavage within the Democratic Party, right? But, I mean, I think later on they tried to make up for it, right? I mean, they had some of the important issues that have animated young people, like gun control and climate change, right? You had the musical performances by Billie Eilish, which, you know, most people over 50 or 60 had no idea who she was. But, I mean, she has, you know, 60 million followers on Instagram. So, you know, maybe that did something to get young people to pay attention.
Well, one of the things that struck me is looking at this convention is that we may be seeing a transition of sorts between what used to be the Democratic Leadership Council, the group that came out of the 1980s. Bill Clinton was obviously an advocate of it, in which there was a shift to more conservative or shift to the right for the Democratic Party, particularly during the 1990s, as a reaction to Reagan. We're now seeing, though, another generation, which oddly enough is represented by Bernie Sanders, but it's a progressive wing, which is pushing now beyond that Democratic Leadership Council idea of a reaction to Reaganism. Mike, do you think that's true?
Oh, absolutely. I think one way to put it is, when Bill Clinton said, when he was nominated, the era of big government is over, the progressive response now is, enter big government, enter activist federal programs, and the federal government is the only institution that can really save us, in effect. And even Biden, who really represents more the Clinton perspective, I would suggest, in his speech, he ticked off, you know, the pandemic, climate change, healthcare, and the like, and unemployment, that in so that there is at least a hint that if a Biden presidency would at least be supportive of significantly greater federal government involvement and regulation and programs alike. I would hasten to say as well, the divisions within the Democratic Party remain big, because we didn't hear Medicare for all. We didn't hear the Green New Deal. We didn't hear a wealth tax, which are all, I think, critical policy positions, ideological policy positions of the progressive left, that I think if Biden does win, then the pressure will be on for those particular programs. But that was sort of hazed over in the convention.
Adam, I want to turn to, by the way, the Republicans that were there. I mentioned a moment ago that they were not obviously the A-team, whatever that may be. How effective do you think they were? I mean, we had a lot of disaffected Republicans, but what does that really represent? Is that just simply a reaction to Donald Trump, and when it's all over, they all go back to the old party? What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think you had, you know, the Democrats had that parade of Republican office holders, you know, saying that they endorsed Biden, not because necessarily they agreed with him and his policies, but, you know, they're focusing solely on Trump. They couldn't bear watching what Trump was doing to their party, was doing to their country. And I think it might have some effect. I mean, along with the Lincoln Project and so forth, it gives some moderate, centrist Republicans sort of a little bit of cover, a little bit of confidence that they could, vote for someone other than a Republican for president. And, you know, even if they end up splitting their chicken and voting for their representatives who are Republican, this would be the time, as, you know, given permission, given sort of that suggestion by fellow Republicans, that now is the time that you could pull the lever for someone with a D, at least at the presidential level. So I think that might have had a sort of some impact. Just for a second, I just want to go back to what you were talking about before, the battle between progressives and sort of the more corporate DLC Democratic Party. Yeah, I mean, I think that's extremely important. In the press, the party got a little bit of flack because at the very last minute, the platform, they took out a very important point about giving subsidies to fossil fuel industries, and the environmentalists were just fuming at the fact that they did that at the last minute. But that clearly represents this sort of intra-battle war that they're having now, and that they will certainly have if Biden gets elected within the Democratic Party in Congress.
Now, Michael, I'll turn to you finally quickly in the minute we have left. What do you think we expect from the Republicans next week?
It's a fascinating. I don't know. I mean, I was thinking about this on the way over, actually. So, what's going to be the reaction here, or what's going to be the how will the? I mean, it's going to be a Trump show, and the focus. I suspect we'll see the law and order theme carried out here. I suspect we will see. I mean, Trump is a character assassin, and so I think there's going to be a lot of attack on Joe Biden's age and Sleepy Joe, that kind of thing. I think will appear as well. I think there will be appeal to what preceded the pandemic. I mean, the strength of the economy and the like. I think we're going to have this notion that, well, if not for the pandemic, things would be wonderful. The pandemic, the virus will disappear, and we'll get back to the good old days prior to the pandemic. So my suspicion will be that that'll be the kind of character of it, but only Trump knows.
Well, on that note,
the culture wars.
The culture wars. Culture. Well, we've been speaking with two political scientists from Salisbury University, Adam Hoffman, as well as Michael Laughlin. Appreciate both of you taking the time to sit in and talk about this morning.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Don.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
Without a doubt, Says You is the toughest quiz show on the air and one of the funniest forms of recreational thinking.
A neoplasm is a new growth about which we may want to be concerned. And a pleonasm...
It's a sneeze you don't cover.
Yes.
Spirited and civil, brainy and boisterous with quotable bon mots, Says You.
Saturdays at 10 on WSDL 90.7 FM.
Preacher Green walked behind his plow, his arms molded to plow iron as though he and the plow and the mule were one, sinking into the wet brown earth together. The plow lodged a stone. The mule strained. The plow dragged. He stopped to dislodge a rock. when from the distant woods he heard the barking of dogs. His flesh crawled. Barbara Lockhart, in her historical novel, Elizabeth's Field. Welcome to Delmarva today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Barbara Lockhart is my guest today, and we're talking about her historical novel, Elizabeth's Field. Elizabeth's Field depicts the struggles of the Black population, free and slave, living on Maryland's eastern shore in the 1850s. In the face of oppression, cruelty, and fear, it's the story of a people with astounding resilience and endurance, whose only hope in that day was flight. Barbara's novel was recognized with a silver medal from the Independent Book Publishers Award. She has also received two individual artist awards in fiction from the Maryland State Arts Council for her short stories and for her novel, Requiem for a Summer Cottage. Barbara, welcome to Delmarva today.
Thank you very much, and I so much appreciate the invitation to speak with you.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here, Barbara. Let me begin by asking you to tell us about your novel, Elizabeth's Field. I gave our audience a little hint from my introduction, but a number of things. What is it about? What is its genesis? How did you come about writing this extensive story? And as historical fiction, what was your intent in writing it?
Well, it kind of all began when my boundaries to my farm of 22 acres was being questioned by the neighboring farmer. And so I had cause to look at all the deeds to my land, which had been in the same place since 1843. And as I was doing the research for that, I discovered a deed issued in 1852 to Elizabeth Burton, who, as noted on the deed, was called a free negress. The next deed, 5 years later, 1857, she lost the farm. And I was very curious about that. I had very little information about Elizabeth, and yet I knew the land, I knew the setting, and I kind of felt it hadn't changed much in 150 years. So I delved into the history. It took me from the beginning of the research to the final sentence of the book. It took me 9 years. But that was the genesis of the novel. I never really planned to write a history for our African-American population. And I questioned myself all through the writing whether I had the right as a white person to write this history. But the more I delved into the details, I just was obsessed with it, actually. And it was more that it was not my intent, clearly, about the book, but my interest was fired up. And at the same time, there was a movement in this county in Dorchester that the interest in Harriet Tubman and that period of life was just coming to the fore after it had been very quiet and buried and silent for years.
Barbara, let me go back and ask you about your sense that you wondered if you had the right to write a story, an African-American perspective about their period in history. This is an issue, I think, in literature. I've heard critics and authors discuss whether, for instance, people who have not suffered a trauma can write about trauma So tell me, how did you arrive at the decision that you could write about this period in history from the Black perspective?
I think as a writer of historical fiction, the best way to approach it is through universal truths. We all know what it feels like to love, to hate, to be afraid, to be jealous. All those human truths, that's what you rely on after you get the facts together. You can imagine how it felt. And how it felt is more important to me than just about anything else when I'm writing.
Well, I agree with you. And I want to ask another question in a similar vein. At the beginning of your novel, you say that this is a work of fiction, and the characters come from your imagination. Is that true of Elizabeth as well? Because you cite a moment ago a deed from Elizabeth Burton.
I had very little information about Elizabeth Burton, which was good in a way, because I could fictionalize her life. I had the deeds, of course. I had a copy of her will when she intended the farm to go to the children. And I had the papers where she manumitted her husband. She actually bought her husband and freed him. So, and then I had a newspaper article about the auction for the land, which happened very quickly after Elizabeth's death, where in most cases, having an auction for the land took a year or more. This auction took place in 6 weeks. So it seemed to me that people were after the land, and that was key. She only had the farm for 5 years. I wanted to know why. I wanted to know what life was like in Dorchester County in that time period. And I researched for about 9 years off and on. And from the first beginning of the research to the last sentence of the book took 9 years.
What you had to do, it seems to me, though, was take Elizabeth Burton and imagine her life. Am I correct in that is what you did?
Exactly. And it wasn't too hard to imagine, because my farm is right in the middle of between the Choptank River and the Nanticoke. Therefore, we were very close to the Choptank settlement, Indian settlement, and very close to the Nanticoke Indian settlement. So it was easy for me to think of Elizabeth as partly Indian. At the time, in the census, the Indians were not listed separately. They were listed as free Blacks. And so there were a number of families who had mixed heritage. So that was one thing that I took the liberty of doing. The other thing is that I know the land very well. This is my farm, and it has not changed very much at all in 150 years. So that was key to me as well. But a very important aspect of this was my neighbor, Mary Taylor. Now, Mary passed away at the age of 80, and we became friends. And she told me her life story. And that oral history gave me the voice for the book, and I will be ever grateful to her. I recorded her stories, and they are now in the Maryland archive, a fact of which she was very proud. But if it was not for Mary, I don't think I would have found the voice for Elizabeth. I depended quite heavily on what Mary told me and how she expressed herself.
Are there other characters in your novel that are like Elizabeth in the sense that they are real people?
Actually, yes. But the other main character, of course, was Sam Green. And his wife, Kitty, was very much like Elizabeth. This idea of carrying on, this strong sense of community, the strength that it took to see your way. When I think about a free, single woman raising children back here in the woods, I am astounded, especially, there were no cars, there was no telephone, but she made her way here on this land in very primitive circumstances. The strength of these women is really astonishing. Now, Sam Green, his story, I stuck to the facts as close as I could. And there was very little written about him at the time. There was an explosion of interest in Harriet Tubman era history in this county 10, 12 years ago. That's why we wound up at the Federal Park honoring Harriet Tubman, the wonderful mural in Cambridge, the museum in Cambridge, and many books that have since been written about that era. And that is largely due to a local historian called John Creighton, who spent his life doing genealogical research on the families that left the shore, ran away, changed their names, a remarkable research. And John had workshops just as I was beginning this book. And it was a godsend because I went to every lecture that he gave and learned so much. And out of that workshop, several books have been written, including Kate Larson's book, Bound for the Promised Land. So there was material around. It took a lot of digging.
Well, let me ask you to reflect a little bit on what you have created here with this, I think, excellent novel. Did you intend Elizabeth Field to stand as some kind of a symbol, or is it more or less the vehicle around which you built the story of her life?
It's difficult to answer that question because I don't think of the field as a symbol at all. What I'm interested in is the story. And what happened with the story was I just simply took the period of 1850 onward and delved into the research for that. But when I talked to Mary Taylor, it changed the structure of the book because here was a woman who was working the same field that Elizabeth did 150 years later, and her conditions were not that much better. And it was with Mary's voice, who became Maddie, I was able to structure the book where she would enter the conversation periodically in the book about her life, about the present time when she actually lived in Georgia and experienced the Ku Klux Klan and being a sharecropper and being very, very poor, becoming a farm worker. Without that reality, the history was no longer for me on the periphery, as it had been all my life. You hear about this, you hear about that. When you're across from someone who actually experienced these things, it's quite a different thing. And so she fleshed out feelings and thoughts about God, about church, about her person that she worked for, voting during that time, and just what it was like to be so segregated from the white population.
Well, I found actually Preacher Green to be a fascinating character. He struggles with his own thoughts and beliefs like most of us do. He tries to reconcile his belief in God with the evil he sees in the world around him. He's also morally conflicted by his false acquiescence to the treatment that he and others are receiving at the hands of the white farmers and the white community generally. And then finally, he expresses this deep sense of guilt. Tell us about Preacher Green, if you would. He is, I believe, an incredibly human character.
Well, in my view, he lived two lives. One, he was very popular in the white community because he was a respectable farmer, and he worked very hard. And the secret part of him was being an agent for the Underground Railroad. So he played the game for the white. He knew how to go about his life so that he would be trusted by the white community and pretty much left alone. And then later, when he is sent to prison, I don't think he ever doubted the morality of what he was doing with the Underground Railroad. I think he knew, though, that he would eventually be caught. And so the section where you may have read about him feeling guilty, he was just acknowledging while he's sitting in the jail, in the cell, that he knew he would be caught. And he had two trials. The first one, he was freed from because they couldn't find any actual evidence of his activity on the Underground Railroad. However, when they searched his house, they found a copy of Uncle Tom's Cabin. And because the first trial didn't work out, there were people who were bent on getting him convicted. And so they charged him with reading a copy of Uncle Tom's Cabin because they thought it was incendiary material. So he knew they were going to get him. It was just a matter of time. So when he talks about the guilt, it's only that he knows he's guilty. He knows what's going to happen. And yet he had the courage to see it through. He could do nothing else. And it was at that point where he was beginning to question his fate because of the terrible injustice.
I think that Preacher Green, as I said, is a fascinating character. And I think he carries all of the moral conflicts that a lot of us struggle with. A fear is, to me, a palpable element in the novel. And there is certainly fear in the Black community, fear of being captured and sold south to the cotton fields, fear of being beaten, fear of having your daughters taken away to be used as, quote, breeders, fear of having your sons taken away for the price that they will bring. So fear is very, very real in your novel. But in reading deeply in your work, I thought that I found another kind of fear. I got the sense of a fear in the white community, the fear of losing their domination, the fear of losing this way of life that they would consider very beneficial to them. Did you have the sense as you were writing of this fear, and could you speak to that for a moment?
Well, I'm guessing, of course, about the fear of the white population. I do hint about it in the prologue of the book. But I do think that when somebody who's supremacist thinking, they need to feel that they can oppress people to keep them in line. And the Black population was working very hard to find some kind of way to run away or to stick it out. But the whole question was economical. Farms could not be run and harvested without the population, the Black population, to do the work. It's pretty simple. And if you had a slave, you could rent him out to work on other farms and collect the pay for that. Free Blacks had to give their time to digging ditches the sides of the roads to help them drain, because this land is very flat and apt to flood. a white overseer had to attend all the black churches during Sunday morning services to be sure that they were not gathering up and trying to make trouble. There were that stone that lodged in the plow for Sam Green at the beginning. You're right. That was a big symbol for the idea that oppressed people have nowhere to turn. And it's remarkable that they survived and carried on with dignity and with a very strong sense of community, helping each other.
I found a resonance in the sense that I at least got anyway of the fear in the white community and therefore the dominance, the beatings, the having to denigrate the black community so much. I found an interesting resonance in the taking down of the Confederate monuments today, and the sense that these monuments stand for some people for much more than a stone structure. And I found the sense of the same kind of fear of their losing some kind of dominance, of some kind of sense of who they are. But anyway, that's just me. And
well, we see evidence of that with what's happening now, Hal. There are sections of our community and our population who are hell-bent on keeping the white supremacy philosophy going. It's a terrifying thing to let go of that for some people, which is where we are at the moment.
Well, that's exactly what I thought. And that's what I got in reading, in getting the subtle sense in your novel of the fear in the white community at that time. Well,
and don't forget the Confessions of Nat Turner, the whole idea of Nat Turner turning on the white population spread a lot of fear among the white people of that era. The thought that a man could come in and murder, gather people of his own kind and come in and murder the owner of the plantation and all that went with this. So that was constantly on people's minds here. This Eastern Shore was very much of Southern sentiment. Western Shore was a mix, but not as much as the Eastern Shore. And that has carried over to the present day.
Well, Barbara, I started the program with the quote you wrote about Preacher Green and the plow lodging against the stone. And it just seemed to me that this is a metaphor for your entire book, that this agrarian community were always running up against the stones in their lives and in their work that were a threat, that were inhibiting. And I guess my sense was, how does the seed, and I just saw it as the planting of the seed of justice. And so the sense, how does the seed of justice get planted and nourished and harvested, and how does it overcome the stones that are lodged in their path?
That is a very big question, Hal. But I hope that we see each other in human terms, and not so much the color of skin. After all, our blood is all the same color. And to have community of a different kind that can appreciate the universal truths. In my book on short stories, there are two stories that exemplify the idea about the universal truth of a mother being very worried about her son who has committed murder. The tension she felt in that child as he was growing up. everybody goes through experiences where they worry about their kids. This is universal. It has nothing to do with color of skin. And the second story is called Christine's Story. And this is a child whose paper was not accepted by the teacher because it wasn't written in pen ink. This child I happen to know, and she was a migrant worker. She didn't have a pen, that's for sure. And so to take extra time to help is so important instead of overlooking people. And that comes only through appreciating the humanity and everything. So the ending of the book is Maddie talking. And she's talking about the end of the book, but also what her hope is. And this is my hope, too. She says, now I'm done looking back. I can look ahead. I see trees growing on Elizabeth's field, their roots holding Elizabeth's and Perry's bones. Deer come and fox and hundreds of birds. Everything what went away is coming back, covering everything over with life. What's left is the story. Pass it along with yours. The telling keeps us understanding things. One of the things that we must do as a society is listen to each other and talk to each other. We are still so very segregated on Sunday morning. Probably the only place for sure that we're not segregated is in the school system. So I have much hope for that. Do we have time for a quick story? When I began teaching in Dorchester County, it was my firsthand knowledge of being with African American people and talking with them. And that, I feel, is my real life education that my degrees in college education neglected to mention. When you're sitting across from somebody and hear the story, it makes a difference. But in my teaching years, we were talking one day about twins. It's something that came up in the story. And of course, I'm white, and my children's aide, Vernetta, is black. And one of the kids said, oh, twins like you and Miss Pinder. And I said, well, let's think about that a minute. Why couldn't we be twins? We talked about having the same mommy, having the same birthday. Vernetta and I are years apart. She's much younger than me, and her skin is very dark. And the kids were pondering. They couldn't figure out why we weren't twins. And one brave soul raised her hand and said, I know why you're not twins. You've got different earrings on. And I thought, what a story. If we could just see each other as people and forget all the other stuff, which of course is difficult to do, but it must be done. My hope for this pandemic that we're going through is that we will develop a better sense of community for everybody.
Barbara Lockhart, you're a wonderful writer. And Elizabeth's field is certainly relevant to today's world. Thanks for joining me on Delmarva today. And thanks to all of you for joining me as well. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.